that we go ahead and start, not make everybody wait. So welcome to the town hall on National Realty Investment Advisors. This is the first town hall post confirmation, at least I should say entry, I should say the confirmation hearing. But we'll give you some updates and information throughout the meeting. I'd like to start though with introductions. So obviously for those who have participated in prior calls, I'm Louis DeLucia Vice Miller, counsel to the Official Committee of Unsecured Creditors. And with me on this call are Michael Ott, also from Vice Miller. And I believe he should be joining, if not already, Dan Polacek and possibly Allison Fiedler from Vice Miller as well, counsel to the committee. Also on the call is Alvarez and Marcel, financial advisors to the committee, which include Andrea Gonzalez, Bill Waldy, and potentially others. Also on the call is counsel to the debtors, Jason Teal of Sills Cummins. And we are joining for the first time, having joined for the first time after the confirmation hearing, we have the proposed trustee, a liquidation trustee, Matthew Ward, who will be joining us and is on the call, as well as the proposed CEO for the property wind down entities, Rick Budd, who is also with us today. So this will be an opportunity for some of you to meet them and hear some of their information. So with that, I can start by discussing where we are and where we're going next. And obviously the opportunity for the liquidation trustee, proposed liquidation trustee, and Rick Budd, proposed CEO for the wind down entities to pitch in as well. But let's start with the most momentous event and why this call is today, which is the confirmation hearing, which occurred on August 1st. That confirmation hearing was a near full day hearing where, in addition to approval of the bankruptcy plan that was filed and you all saw by the bankruptcy court, there were other motions heard as well. But the star of the day was the plan of liquidation that was considered by the court. And from the bench, the judge indicated he would be, quote, confirming the plan. What that means is basically approving it. That plan, you will recall, provides for the liquidation, the development and or sale liquidation of the real estate, the creation of a liquidation trust, the appointment of a liquidation trustee, the appointment of a CEO to manage those properties through the liquidation, development, and sale process, and the distribution to investors and creditors of funds recovered from those sales of real estate as well as litigation recoveries. That plan was voted on by all of the investors and creditors that received notice, and not everyone voted, but we had well over 1,200 votes, of which more than 98% approved. We had, that's the investor class. All of the secured creditors who originally had problems and issues under the plan were resolved. So S3 and Torac both voted in favor of the plan. So the secured lender class voted in favor of the plan. Other objections were resolved, but we did have other objectors whose objections were resolved on the record and were not really objections that would have impaired the confirmation. I would like to add, though, that that result was because of the hard work, obviously, of this committee, who is also on this call, the committee members who were instrumental in conjunction with the debtors in working towards a consensual plan. They worked tirelessly, week after week, meeting on calls with its professionals. Each member of this committee was instrumental to making the decisions that ultimately led to, we think, a recovery for, we hope for these investors, all of you, that will come from both real estate and litigation. So my hats off to, and my compliments and appreciation for this committee, as well as the debtors who worked with us to get this through confirmation. We're still waiting, and here's the procedural issue on this plan. We're still waiting for the order actually to be entered by the judge. And the reason for that is that it's a 50-something page order, so it's not inconsequential, and the judge is reading it, analyzing it, and going to approve it, we hope. Also because there's some language issues that were raised by certain creditors who believe that there should be some nuancing to it. So we're working through that, and we've submitted a revised draft today. So hopefully the judge will enter that order in short order, and we will have an order approved by the court confirming the plan. So what does that do? Once that order is entered, certain steps have to be taken to get to the next step. And the next step is the effective date of the plan. The effective date of the plan is when the entire plan becomes really effective or really effective, and the estate of the debtor is now terminated, the committee is now terminated, and the trust is created, the wind down entities are created, and the assets that were held by the debtors are transferred to the wind down entities for purposes of management, development, completion, and sale by the trustee and the wind down entities. So that is what the effective date will trigger. There are certain conditions to that effective date. They're in Section 7, Article 7, I should say, of the plan, which you should all have copies of. And there are basically what I said. The documents have to be drafted. The order has to be entered approving the plan. The properties have to be transferred. And essentially, no government or other obstructions to the effective transfer of those properties are in place. So we should have that effective date targeted realistically by the end of August is what we'd anticipate by it becoming effective, largely because of the steps that have to be taken to do that. So we're working with the debtors and the other professionals in the case to complete that documentation. So once that happens, there's going to be a liquidation trust. That liquidation trust will have a trustee who I've indicated is Matthew, is an entity who is going to be run by Matthew Ward, who is on this call. And that trustee will have the responsibility of managing the estate, the trust, I should say, for claims reviews, for claims and litigation prosecution, for working with Rick Budd in managing the real estate and the development and sale of that real estate to recover proceeds for the payment of distribution of resolved claims. It will take a period of time to do that. As you know, the plan is a complex document, but also there's a lot to do to get those recoveries to you. Like I mentioned, the wind down entities will be run by Rick. There's going to be 17 or 18 of them. There's going to be a trust in all likelihood. And we're still, of course, waiting for the order, as I mentioned. But the idea is that there'll be the trust. Below that will be a holdco. That holdco will then own the operating real property entities below. And they'll all be managed that way. So next is going to be, obviously, the claims process. And I think, Mike, you're going to be just discussing that briefly. Michael Ott from Ice Miller.
Yeah. So I can discuss that very
briefly. Mute, Mike.
Oh, can you hear me now? I think I should be off mute. Can you hear me? No one can hear me.
I can hear you, Mike.
Okay, you can hear me. Good. All right. In terms of the claims process, so
Mike, really, I can't hear you.
Rick just
said, can anyone else hear Mike?
I can hear him. Matthew, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. Okay. In terms of the claims process, really there's effectively two tracks at this point. There's the track for the contributing investors. If you'll remember, under the contributing investor settlement in the plan, investors who did not opt out of the contributing investor settlement, either by submitting a ballot, selecting the opt-out option, or voting to reject the plan or submitting an objection to the plan, are contributing. Anybody who didn't do one of those things is a contributing investor. Contributing investor claims will be allowed on the effective date in the amounts set forth on the investor schedule, which is attached as Exhibit 3 to the plan. Now, we understand that there are potentially some allocation issues with respect to the claims, specifically, you know, allocation between, IRA accounts and personal accounts. And we obviously want to make sure that those are allocated correctly and not to cause tax issues. To the extent that there is an allocation issue in your claim as listed in the investor schedule, please send me an email. You can find my email address on the website, the Omni website, but I'm also going to put it in chat right now. And we will work on getting your claim allocation correct. The other issue is there are some people who have disputed the specific amounts in the investor schedule. To the extent that you have a question with respect to the amounts in the investor schedule, meaning, you know, what is, how is your original principal calculated? How are your pre-petition distributions calculated? And what are the additional reductions that are on the schedule? Please shoot me an email laying out what you think it should be and what you think your question is. And I will work with the debtors to get back to you on that. But for the most part, by accepting the contributing investor settlement, everybody is now locked into the formula of cash in, cash out. And for the most part, everybody will be locked into the amount subject to the allocation issues and some questions about the amounts. To the extent that it's a small amount, a couple hundred dollars, a couple thousand dollars, remember, this is just the denominator for your claim. This is the amount that your claim will be calculated on. We will, you know, if it's a big difference, we'll go through it. If it's a small difference, it may not be, it may take too much time to resolve and not make enough of a difference to your claim to spend the time to do it. But we will at least review the emails. So that's the contributing investors. For the non-contributing investors, for anybody who opted out of the settlement, by either opting out their ballot, by objecting to the plan, or by rejecting the plan. You can also reach out to me via email to lay out why you think your claim should be calculated differently than it's on the net investor schedule. If we can work something out consensually before there's any need to file a claim objection, I'm happy to do so. We will work together to, come at what the correct amount of your claim should be. If we are unable to reach an agreement, then ultimately we will file an objection to your claim. For the investors who are not contributing investors who are excluded parties. Additionally, if we aren't able to work out some sort of resolution, then there will be an objection to your claim filed and potentially an avoidance action brought, against you on behalf of the estate to recover amounts that you received pre-petition. Now, there are two deadlines for the non-contributing investors that they need to be aware of. The first deadline is June 7th of 2024, which is the 2-year anniversary of the bankruptcy case. That is the deadline by which all avoidance actions and litigation of the estate needs to be brought. So if June 7th, 2024 comes and goes and there's no order of the court extending that deadline or there's no action filed against you, then at that point, there likely won't be any action filed against you. The next deadline to be aware of, and this one isn't quite set yet, but the current deadline for objecting to claims is 1 year after the effective date of the plan. Now, as Lewis said, there are a number of things that have to happen before the plan becomes effective. As soon as those things do happen, we will file a notice of effective date on the docket, which will make clear what that effective date is. And then there are several different dates under the plan that all are calculated off of that effective date, including that claim objection deadline, which is 1 year after the effective date. So that'll be set soon, as soon as the plan becomes effective, there'll be a notice filed. But all objections to claims would need to be filed by that deadline, unless, as frequently happen, an extension is sought to that deadline to, you know, further extend the time that the trust can object to claims, which frequently happens in these types of cases. I can't say whether or not it's going to happen here. Very well could. But one of the nice things about the contributing investor settlement is the vast majority of investors have accepted the settlement. So the number of claim objections that will need to be filed is small. Having said that, in order to ensure that there is a clean claims register for all of the claims, I would anticipate that we will be filing a couple of what's called omnibus claim objections. These are objections in bulk to claims for a number of reasons in order to essentially clean up the claims register so you don't have a bunch of duplicative claims. You know, many investors filed one claim and then they amended it and then they amended it again. The way the claim register is written, each one of those counts as a separate claim until we basically clean it up by filing these omnibus claim objections merely to clean up the docket. So given that all of the contributing investor, most of the contributing investors have submitted proofs of claim, I would anticipate that we would be filing an omnibus claim objection to establish that their claim is allowed in the amount set forth in the net investor schedule and that any claims they filed are therefore deemed waived because of the settlement. We will make it very clear in that document what the import of that is, what the effect of that will be. That should not affect your ultimate claim. It's really just to clean up the docket, but I would anticipate that in the next several months, we'll be filing several of those just to clean up the docket. In terms of a couple of other small things, to the extent that you currently have an IRA custodian and you would like to change your IRA custodian, the liquidation trust accounts for that. And basically, if you want to change your IRA custodian, then you need to work with your custodian, find a new custodian that you can roll your IRA into. And then once you've filled out whatever paperwork your custodian requires and whatever paperwork the new custodian requires, please send that notice to the liquidation trust and we'll make sure that it gets listed on the register so that you have the appropriate person listed as the custodian for your IRA. And I think there's a deadline set of 90 days after the effective date to do that. So please, that should be plenty of time. If you've already accomplished that, then please go ahead and compile your paperwork and you can start sending that into the trust and we'll make sure that gets recorded so that the appropriate custodian is receiving the notices and receiving any distributions that are made. The last thing, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little later as well, is K-1s. I know that many investors there was a lot of issues with the K-1s that were issued last year by the debtors. And there have been no K-1s issued, obviously, for 2022 yet, which I know has delayed many of you filing your 2022 tax returns. The debtor received an extension of time to file their tax returns until September 15th, and their tax returns will be filed by September 15th, at which point the Schedule K-1s for 2022 will be issued. There are discussions ongoing about whether or not the trust will amend prior year tax returns or to go with that to resolve some of the difficulties that were caused by the K-1s that came out last year. Those discussions are ongoing and no decisions, as far as I'm aware, have been made as of yet. But we will report further on that as we have more information. I think that's the claims process. Lewis?
All right. Thank you, Mike. Thank you. So with that, I think we'll pass the baton to Rick. Everyone, if you haven't seen him, I think he did appear once before, but we have Rick Budd here on the platform. He is slated to be the CEO for the wind down entities for purposes of managing the properties. So I'll turn it over to you, Rick.
Sure. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thanks. Thanks, Lewis. I'll be brief. We've been dealing, with the real estate assets that we have. For those of you following the market and things, the real estate markets continue to be, quite unsettled. You've seen bank downgrades, higher interest rates. The implications for us is that that means banks become more skittish and don't want to finance things. And not financing things then creates our potential buyers another hurdle to get over. We've been selective. There have been plenty of distressed buyers that have approached us, and we have, avoided dumping anything or panicking in any way. We also believe that having the bankruptcy behind us after the effective date will also help to clarify the situation and advertise to people that this is not a a literal going out of business sale that has to have a date in 90 days or something like that. So we continue to believe we do have assets that are in quality locations. And in the long run, we think that will be ultimately very helpful to us. We have executed two contracts on parcels in New Jersey. We expect those to close within the next 60 days or so. And we are pretty close on another two assets also in New Jersey, which if that materializes would be by the end of the year. So we're happy with those prices. Those will be disclosed at the right time. We also have, we have had three condominiums that have been available for sale, two in Philadelphia, one in Brooklyn. And we're happy to tell you we're under contract on all three of those just in the last 30 days. So they will close again between now and probably the end of October. So there are some positive signs. We also have been contacted by, I would say, quality counterparties who are interested in potentially joint venturing with us on a couple of our larger assets. Just without getting into details, joint ventures are opportunities for us to partner with again, high quality, reputable firm that would be a longer term investment period, but a higher ultimate return. So it's a long way from here to there. And we are mindful of that, but we continue to run out all the possible opportunities that are coming down the pipe. So, I look forward to working with Matthew, going forward and, creating as much value as we can.
Thanks, Rick, very much. I think the next, so that's the real estate summary. I know many of you know the real estate, and it is touched on in the disclosure statement, of course, describing it, and we've had prior calls about it. So Rick will be managing those going forward with the oversight and collaboration of the liquidation trustee. So thank you. And then now we have the investigation and litigation update, which I think A&M will be sharing, Alvarez and Marcel. And that's Bill Waldy from Alvarez. Thank you, Bill.
Thanks, Lewis. Yeah, we talked before, so some of this we may go over a few things we talked about before, but the way the investigation's moving right now is, we're going through and combing through, tons of information. There's 6.2 million documents that we have now that we've been going through and finding evidence as we track down and follow the money here. Over 80 subpoenas have been served. We have close to 300,000 lines of bank information that's come in. So we're following the money as this money is very layered. And what I mean by that is it moves from one person through another entity before it gets to its final destination. So there's not just direct transactions between some of these entities and individuals, not only the insiders and the people who were the organizers of the scheme, but others that may have been involved or should have done things or should have caught things to stop this in its tracks, and they didn't. And what do I mean by that? So, we have these bucketed out because it's not just, although we've done deep dive asset tracing, we've found millions of dollars of assets tied to the insiders. We're also looking at other areas through litigation as we work with the Ice Miller team as to where we could pursue causes of action and litigation against, for example, financial institutions, advertising and marketing, reputation management firms, feeder funds, the construction partners, professionals, be it accountants, law firms, and so forth, are areas that we're focusing our concentration on to where we think we have the best chance of recovery. And that's in addition to the real estate sales. And as that's coming, this is going to be through litigation be it RICO or aiding and abetting or whatever the litigations turn up, that's where our heavy focus on the investigation is right now. We've been requesting and hoping to get another batch of documents, which we have negotiated now, where they should be coming in shortly, which is about another million documents in the relevant time period where we think we're going to see even more evidence and activity of wrongdoing, which we can help build out these claims. And what am I talking about here? We see just in the latest hearing that we had, we have certain objections, be it, let me move this big $100 million project out from the plan because it had nothing to do with any malfeasance or wrongdoing by debtors. And we've gone through, we filed a few sworn declarations in response to those objections where we're seeing that, yes, they were involved. There were straw buyers. There was commingled investor money. There was advanced deposits coming as if it was coming from investors that really wasn't. It was coming from other investor funds to make it look like they were deposits for certain transactions. We're seeing false statements provided to lenders and financial institutions. Anything they needed to do to keep the fraud moving are things we're finding and showing these commingling of funds. But that's really where our focus has been now, and it's working now with the different litigation teams who are all broken up, focusing on different pieces of the fraud as we could build our cases to hopefully get big recoveries for the investors in the future. But that's all I got right now, Lewis. I don't know if you want to add more from the legal perspective on that, but that's a high level overview of, you know, what our focus is right now for the investigation.
That's great. Thank you, Bill. I think generally speaking, the for those who participated in prior calls, you know that there are very high level but specific targets, and we've made progress. We've commenced one lawsuit, as you know, against S3, the mortgage lender on two of the properties, a $30+ million claimant that is being pursued. That is a challenge to their liens, but also a demand for recovery of payments. We don't know how that'll turn out, as any litigation could turn out, depending upon how it proceeds. But we have hope that that will resolve favorably for the investors. But there are other big bucket litigations that Bill was touching on that have specific teams assigned to them and are ready to pounce as soon as this trust is up and running, which will be in short order, hopefully augment the 25 to 35% recoveries anticipated from the real estate. But with that, I wanted to turn over on, one of the fundamental themes of the bad acts that occurred prior to this bankruptcy was a Ponzi scheme based upon our analysis or view. Certainly was the view of the authorities and the regulators, the state of New Jersey, the Department of Justice, the SEC, many of whom have already in pleadings asserted Ponzi scheme allegations against the debtors, principals and the debtors, and the certain of the individuals, the principals, such as Salzano, Scaturo, who pled guilty, and Salzano, who is obviously not pled but has been indicted, those allegations and those indictments and those informations as filed against those individuals state that these were Ponzi schemes. The Bureau of Securities asserts it's a Ponzi scheme, and that has implications. We filed a motion for a determination that it was a Ponzi scheme. But for many reasons related to pending litigation, we decided not to proceed in the core case, but we will be dealing with those Ponzi scheme allegations in the pending adversary proceedings. But as to investors, Mike's going to talk about, for those who might have concerns regarding a tax implications of it, I'll turn it over to Mike.
Sure. So I'm going to preface this heavily by making clear that you all need to consult with your own individual tax professionals with respect to your own individual tax situation for what is best for you. There is, and I am not a tax professional, so I'm relaying what I've heard, but again, consult with your own professionals on this. There is a revenue procedure called the theft loss tax deduction. I believe it's revenue procedure 2009-20, but your accountant will correct me if I'm wrong. that allows you to take a qualified loss in a Ponzi scheme situation. And the triggering event for that, one triggering event for that, is my understanding, is that there has been an indictment filed against essentially the principal bad actor. So here, the indictments that were filed against Salzano and Grabato, we believe should in most cases potentially qualify you to take that theft loss deduction. Additionally, the information that was filed against Art Scutaro, the criminal information is like an indictment, but it is agreed upon with the target beforehand when it is filed, typically, although I'm sure Dan will correct me if I'm wrong. That also is probably sufficient to allow you to take the theft loss deduction. But again, I'm not a tax professional, and you need to consult with your own individual tax attorney, tax accountants and whatnot on that. But those two things, the indictments of Grabato and Salzano and the information filed against Scutaro, probably trigger the theft loss deduction and would allow you to take it.
All right. So thank you, Mike. I think with that, we will be turning to the questions that have been both posted on the website through WebEx as well as in the margins. We're trying to do some of those Q&As as we go along as well. So let's start with the questions that came in through the WebEx. One is, when will investors, or the theme, and actually several questions were put into one theme question, which is, when will investors see their first distribution? What percentage of remaining principal owed to investors will be returned, and when, et cetera. The bottom line is that the 25 to 35% stated in the disclosure statement represents the effective anticipated recovery from the real estate for return to investors. We anticipate greater recoveries from the litigation to augment, so go above the 25 to 35% as those funds come in and recoveries are obtained. Obviously, litigation is always uncertain and can take time, but we're hoping that we can get some early recoveries, what we call low-hanging fruit, sooner rather than later once this trust is up and running. So in terms of first distributions, that will have to await at least two things. One is the trust has to be up and established. Two, the liquidation trustee, along with its professionals, will have to walk through the claims as Mike described, make sure that claims that, for example, were filed and are on the dockets that are not appropriate don't dilute your distribution. So if people filed three or four claims duplicatively, they're not going to get three or four payments. We have to make sure that those are all vetted out, cut out, only true claimants get their distribution. Once that's done and we get disputed claims either knocked out or reserved in lower amounts that we can possibly get so that the maximum amount of cash can go out to investors, then we'll start looking at, in consultation with the liquidation trustee, with the CEO on the wind down entities and the professionals, what that distribution date will be. It'll be as soon, the theme behind all of this is going to be as soon as humanly possible, because we recognize the need of individuals for their investments to be returned, and it's only wholly appropriate. So we're doing everything we can. So hopefully now, with the slimming down of the case, the fewer professionals involved, the fewer administrative burdens of a bankruptcy court, we should have a less burn on cash flow and an increased inflow of cash and get the distributions out as soon as we can. To fix a date would be irresponsible of us right now, but we're going to do it as soon as we can in consultation, obviously, with the trustee and the other professionals. Mike, did you want to say something, or?
I would just add that, you know, the fact that we have to make reservations for claims that would have to be paid is probably one of the bigger impediments to getting distributions out quicker. But we are working to prepare motions to estimate, to make sure that we don't have to reserve, you know, large amounts for claims that are only really worth, you know, minimal amounts, so that we can get those reserves down to a manageable number and make sure that we have sufficient assets to make the distributions to investors.
Right. So that's that question. The next question is, does The $168 million in net proceeds from real estate estimate correspond to a 25% recovery or a 35% recovery to investor claims. Andrea?
Thanks, Lewis. Just wanted to kind of circle back on the recovery and how your recovery is calculated. So the recovery essentially is the amount of proceeds available after paying admin expenses in classes 1 through 4, which are paid in full under the plan. And then we're at distributable assets available to the investors or class 5. That is then divided by the overall claims of the investors. So that's how your recovery is derived. The question refers to the $168 million of proceeds from the real estate, which is from the disclosure statement, but that's not the only component that's considered to go to your recovery. It's the $168 net proceeds for the real estate assets, so the $17 that will be continued to be developed and sold during the trust, plus the cash, plus all the completed assets, any remaining assets that haven't been sold that will be sold. So that is the pool of assets that's available for distribution, but it has to first go through the waterfall whereby all of the claimants that sit above class 5 are paid first, and then the remaining drops down to pay the investors in class 5. So if you consider those numbers, which are all estimates based on the at the time of the disclosure statement being filed, and is subject to change, but if we just look at those numbers and draw a line in the sand, your recovery would basically be in the middle of the 25 to 35% range. It's an estimate, as I just mentioned. Lewis has mentioned this a number of times. I know Rick touched upon this generally as well. The reason for the range is because it is uncertain at this time until the assets are sold how much will be available for distribution, but also the bottom number of the claims and until the claims reconciliation process is complete.
Andrea, I think you froze, Andrea, I think. Okay, I think we might have lost her there, but she'll come back. All right, I think she generally answered the question that, you know, there's a waterfall, if you wish, but that's how it's calculated, and it will be generally calculated from those recoveries. So,
and one other thing I'd add is that it's a present value calculation. The total amount of payments you receive might be a slightly larger amount than 30% of your claim, but one thing we wanted to do with that was make sure that you're comparing apples to apples. So 25 to 30% of your, you know, current the value of your current claim, even though it might take a few years to actually accomplish that. So it's going to be probably a little bit more in nominal terms.
All right. So thanks, Mike. That's true. Next question. I voted on the plan, but opted out of payment, I think it is, or because the NRIA claim amounts appear inaccurate. How to resolve so that I can get paid correctly? Mike?
Yeah, I'll take that, and I'll also read the next question as well, because I think it's roughly the same question. What are we doing about reconciling issues, and when will we be contacted to confirm our claim amounts? So the first question is about investors that opted out of the settlement. If you opted out of the settlement, please feel free to reach out to me. If you don't reach out to me, we will be reaching out to you at some point to basically set forth what we believe your claim should be allowed at and give you an opportunity to respond to that before we have to resort to filing a claim objection. If you reach out to me with your backup why you think your claim should be, you know, X dollars as opposed to what's on the investor schedule, that would speed up that process. So that is for the non-contributing investors. For the contributing investors, if you are a contributing investor and you do not reach out to us to try and get the value of your claim corrected, then your claim will be allowed in the amount that's set forth in the schedule. I know that there are a number, you know, I'm going through a backlog of emails, and there are a few that are still off. I talked to some investors today about that. I'm working to get that resolved and just make sure everything's consistent. But if you're contributing investors, then we won't be reaching out to you unless you reach out to us. So I think that answers that question.
Right. All right, thanks. So the next question is transfers of investor claims. How many of the investor claims have been transferred to third party collectors? Why? Okay, so the answer is roughly 60 claims have been transferred out of the nearly 2,000, so it's not an extraordinary number. Those are claims to purchasers more than collectors. They're basically people trying to arbitrage or buy it at discount below that 25% to 35% anticipated recovery so that they can make up the spread on your claim that they purchase if you were to sell it. And it's being done by individuals who believe that they need the funds now as opposed to waiting for it. We assume that's their decision. The rights of the estate and the trustee in connection with the enforceability or allowance of those transfers and whether or not the estate will recognize them is still under advisement. So we're not prepared today to say exactly how the liquidation trustee or the trust will deal with those claims. But that's what we know so far. And there's a number of entities that are buying claims. What is the latest date to sell and assign my claim? The plan, by the way, does provide, and the order should provide, that the claims are not assignable post confirmation. And that would be a prohibition. So theoretically, once this plan goes effective, there'd be a court order, and the order, once it's entered, would essentially provide that it is no longer permissible to sell that claim. It'd be a violation of the court order to do so. There is restrictive language within the private placement memoranda that prohibit the sale of those investment securities, but that is subject to obviously someone else's debate. So we're going to reserve rights as to that, but as to the post confirmation order entry, I think it's pretty clear those are prohibited sales. Investments transferred to the vultures have any effect on our trying to maximize returns? No, it should have no impact at all. So that's what we have on those questions. Next are tax issues. I think we've covered a fair amount of that. Mike covered the 2022 tax filing, the Ponzi scheme issue, the fact that there was a government, DOJ action that allows for the theft loss, should allow for the theft loss, depending upon your tax situation. We answered that. We also answered the K-1 issue. So I think tax issues are covered based on the questions we received. Next is, did the docket paying fee already $900,000 pass or was it rejected? The answer is it was approved by the court as reasonable based upon the court's analysis of what they heard in court in the context of the hourly rate and the market analysis of what was compensable for the CRO. So that was approved. But the investors' comments were submitted to the court for consideration, and the court mentioned that they did have them. So those are the questions that were submitted on the WebEx. Let's go to the questions in the sidebar here in the Q&A.
We have the Q&A, and then we also have the chat. I was going to say there are four in the Q&A. Why don't we go through those four first? If we have a change in address, how do we provide as such and where? We will submit a notice to the court, or in the effective date notice, we'll provide an address where notices regarding investor addresses and such should be sent. For right now, changes of address should be sent to Omni. But once the liquidation trust becomes effective, we'll make sure that a notice gets out so you'll know where to send it. The next question is, how will we be kept up to date and how frequent as properties continue to be developed and completed as sold? So in the liquidation trust agreement, we included a provision on periodic reporting that requires the liquidation trustee to host town halls every other month going forward after the effective date of the plan for the first 2 years after the effective date and then quarterly thereafter. So we would anticipate that the plan will become effective this month. And so the next town hall will probably be sometime in early October, where we'll give you updates on how the real estate has been faring, how the real estate has been selling, how the litigation, what litigation has been commenced, any major settlements, much of which will also be filed in the docket, anticipated distributions and whatnot. So again, every other month for the first 2 years after the effective date of the plan, and then every quarterly thereafter until the case is completely resolved. And yeah, that's already been answered. And the question about documentation with respect to the Ponzi scheme, as I mentioned, there is no specific documentation that we would give you, but you should be able to take the indictments that were filed against Salzano and Grabato to your tax accountant and ask him if those are sufficient for you to take a theft loss deduction. Yeah, so those are all the questions in the Q&A. So now we can go to the chat. Louis, you want to start on the chat?
Sure. One is, hi, you mentioned at the beginning that some investors wanted changes to the proposed plan. Can you please elaborate on the changes proposed and if they were accepted by Ice Miller and the court? Well, they weren't quite to the plan, only changes to the order. And, when you have a bunch of lawyers, as you do here with a bunch of claimants and the debtors and the creditors committee and others, lawyers work, their tool of art is language. So there was nuancing regarding language that was really done by and amongst the lawyers. There wasn't anything that would substantively affect distributions or rights of investors. They were largely one-off issues. So for example, there was language that enabled us that was changed in the order to resolve the S3 objection to the plan or the TORAC objection to the plan. And those objections were everything from objecting to substantive consolidation of all the entities, which we know the plan provided for, to treatment of their claims. And by simply preserving rights and saying that nothing in the plan is going to affect their right to defend certain issues within the litigation, because as I mentioned, we're suing S3, they were okay with it. And they just wanted clarifying language that that's what was happening. So nothing that was necessarily going to affect you. There's one positive step that did happen with the assistance of the debtors, which was, there was language inserted regarding some of the EB-5 claimants and funds held in trust or in accounts, I should say, escrows for the EB-5 claimants, and the resolution of those funds and for the benefit of the estate was inserted in the, meaning you, inserted in the order. Other than that, there was largely clarification, reservation of rights type language. It was not something that materially changed anything as to treatment of you under the plan or otherwise. So that's...
I think that there was also at the beginning of this call, we talked about the fact that the confirmation order had not yet been entered because there had been some questions raised with respect to the language in the confirmation order. We believe we have resolved that. We've accepted the proposed language that one of the investors put forward. It just is, I believe, highly technical language with respect to, making reservations for disputed claims prior to any distributions. It's not a substantive change of the plan. It's just clarifying language, but we just have to get that resolved before the court will enter the order. So that's what we were talking about there. So that's the change specifically with respect to the confirmation order that we were discussing earlier.
Right. Next is, will Mr. Budd's company manage all 17 to 18 properties, or will separate wind down entities be opened for each property? When will that occur? Well, the answer is there are going to be 17 to 18, entities created. There will be a holdco right below the trust company, and that holdco will own the 17 subsidiaries for each of the properties. Those are being done all simultaneously with the effective date. So the documents are being drafted, the entities are being created, the deeds are being transferred to those entities, and then we'll have an effective date. The way it's operating is the liquidation trust and trustee is here. The management slash opco is here, holdco, I should say, and then the operating real property entities are below it. And the trustee and the CEO will work together to manage those properties. Direct responsibility for day-to-day management will be Rick and the propcos. So that answers that question. In the best case scenario, what additional percentage of recovery above and beyond 25 to 35% can be expected as of right now with whatever has been discovered from the investigations, i.e. how good is this all looking? We, the investors, would very much like and observe to have some sort of idea. That's a good question and a fair question, especially since this is clearly a massive fraud on all of you. And we have found very good information as to a number of bad actors and a number of defendants, prospective defendants as well. So, for example, there are pending litigations against USC, US Construction, which, by the way, transferred all of its assets and its entities into a new entity known as US Development. So we're chasing them. They're being sued, but they're going to be sued far more. As some of you may have listened, and I can say this because I said it publicly, I said it on the record, we're going to sue USC and their principals for everything they have. And I said that on the record. And I mean that because we're going to, because there are substantial facts as adduced in testimony that if you want to read it, the depositions are on the docket in the Ponzi scheme motion. You can read the depositions of John Farina and Dustin Salzano, which we took in Philadelphia. And we believe that those depositions demonstrate strong cases against U.S. Construction for liability to this estate. That is not inconsequential because, for example, we understand that there are properties, some of which are valued at potentially $100 million. We don't know for sure. That's an estimate. That's just discussion. But they have properties that could be recovered for the benefit of all of you. They have been, received transfers of tens of millions of dollars from this estate. We're going to pursue those recoveries for you. There are lending institutions. We have subpoenas outstanding to TD Bank. We have adduced and found certain facts that are very helpful to us as to TD Bank as well. That is still being developed. And now let me just give a by way of an example, but not evidentiary or support for any actual recoveries here. But by way of example, in other Ponzi scheme cases, lending institutions who have allowed transactions that don't necessarily meet the Know Your Customer rules for banking or the Bank Securities Act or other violations, ignoring acts of fraud or funds moving among insiders in the furtherance of a Ponzi scheme. Those other cases and other banks have been found to be liable for as much as $1.2 billion, $600 million. Example, Deutsche Bank within the recent period was recently found liable for over $600 million. We have other banks held liable, TD Bank in the Stanford case and other cases. So although I can't attest for sure what recovery will be here, those kind of litigations, again, for the big dollars that would, you know, if we hit a home run, get you 100 cents on the dollar, right? So if we get there, TD Bank would be a long litigation, but could be fruitful. So we have to develop that case for sure. We've got millions of pages to go through and depositions to take, which are going to be teed up. There's ongoing fights with discovery with them. There are law firms that were involved pre-bankruptcy that were involved in the drafting and circulation of these private placement memoranda. If they are found to be culpable for failure to, appropriately document or failure to disclose to investors that Nick Salzano remained in the background controlling as a puppeteer all the actions of the debtors, that could be a potential liability to those law firms. And those folks could be responsible, at which point, again, we would sue and get those recoveries. Now, I'm not doing this hypothetically. I'm speaking, this is a recorded meeting that goes on the website. So I'm being purposely cautious about who I'm talking about and what information we have, because it could be used in litigation against us. So that's why I'm doing it. I'm not being coy. Okay. I'm being particularly careful about what I disclose for the very reason I just told you. I don't want bad actors to say, aha, they said this in that recorded, recording. So, but trust me, there's a lot there, and we are going to pursue everything we can for your recovery. And there's going to be a bunch of litigation coming. Another example, we have an entire team dedicated to and have been watching the conditions in FTX and in other cases where the high-profile individuals or entities that were promoting the sales of inappropriate, unregistered securities are being pursued. We have an entire team focused on that. And there is some good information as to certain high profile individuals that we have identified. Example being communications behind the scenes between the person's staff, high profile individual promoting securities, right? Asking questions of the debtors regarding transactions and allowing themselves still to promote a guaranteed 12% rate of return when those questions were asked and they should have known they shouldn't have said that. So that kind of stuff is being literally developed as we speak for the launching of a lawsuit like the FTX case against entities and individuals involved in promoting the securities. We have feeder funds who were out there talking to other investors, paid commissions by the debtors to promote investors coming into the platform. And they therefore were being paid with other investors' money to solicit inappropriate securities for the benefit of these. Those people are going to be sued and have been identified. So when you look at that excluded party list and you say, well, that entity's not an investor, you now know why they're on the list. Okay. And then you could also take a look at on the schedules that we filed recently under the plan supplement of our preserved causes of action. You'll see a whole list of people and entities. These are all people and entities we've identified as potential claimants against whom we intend to pursue claims. So we did the math, right? 25% to 35%. You're talking about $160 to $180 million of actual monies coming from the real estate. That leaves a huge shortfall. And, you know, that's not okay. We want more money for you and greater recoveries. And to some degree, in collaboration with the debtors, we held off on launching those litigations until we stabilized and the debtors stabilized with Rick and others, the real estate and and got that under control, got the costs down, got the staffing down, got the employees down. And then now we're launching into litigation phase two, and it's going to be Armageddon, we hope. So,
and I would just add one point there to what Lewis just said about holding off on bringing claims. There was another major reason we held off on bringing claims, which was to wait for the plan to be confirmed so that the contributing investor settlement would take effect and the contribution to claims to the trust would take effect. Because as the liquidation trust, if there was not that contribution to claims, the liquidation trust would essentially be standing in the shoes of NRIA. And so any claims it could assert would be basically NRIA saying to somebody else, you defrauded me. And the other side would assert a defense called imperi delicto, which basically says, yeah, how did I defraud you? You're the one who was doing the fraud. It's with that, you know, if you've ever seen the movie Casablanca, it's the gambling going on in the casino. Well, you knew the gambling was going on in the casino. How can you really, you know, arrest me for that? So by having the claims contributed and by being able to bring those claims on behalf of the investors as a whole, we don't have that same issue. And so that's one reason why we needed to wait until the plan was confirmed in order to bring these litigations.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly have defenses and arguments that the imperi delicto defense doesn't and wouldn't necessarily apply. So we have those arguments and those defenses, and we certainly believe that there is a legitimate reason why those defenses would fail. But as Mike's pointing out, it just makes our claims incredibly stronger if we can pursue the claims on behalf of defrauded investors as well. And that's why it wasn't done for convenience. The settlement was a strategic litigation/recovery tool to take the benefit of the claimant's claims independent of the NRIA entities and have them asserted against the bad actors that are free and clear of that kind of a defense. And it makes it very comfortable to pursue those claims, as Mike pointed out. So I know that's a little bit of a long-winded question, but it's probably one of the most passionate issues we have on our plate, which is pursuing these bad actors. So it was a good question. Next question. How can I tell whether I am a contributing investor or not? Mike, you want to do that? Mike, are you mute or is it me again?
Yeah, it was me. I was muted. Okay. How can you determine if you are a contributing investor? So under the plan, the contributing investor settlement was an opt-out. So if you did not file a ballot and didn't do anything, if you didn't file a proof of claim, you are a contributing investor. if you filed a ballot accepting the plan and not selecting the opt-out, and you're not an excluded party, you're not on the excluded party list, then you are a contributing investor. The only ways in which you are not a contributing investor are if you are A, on the excluded party list, B, you selected the opt-out when you submitted your ballot, C, you voted to reject the plan, or D, you filed an objection to the plan. If you didn't do one of those four things, you didn't select the opt-out, didn't vote to reject the plan, didn't file an objection to the plan, and you're not listed on the excluded party list, then you are a contributing investor.
Thank you, Mike. Another question is, which parties are subject to RICO? I think that was referring to RICO. Is that correct? I believe that was the intention of that question. RICO is one of the claims that will be contemplating pursuing. That includes state and federal racketeering charges, essentially against the bad actors. It's basically a civil remedy, civil RICO, not federal RICO. It was the same laws, as you know, that were adopted for the federal government to go after the mafia way back in the 30s and 40s and 50s. But this is a civil remedy that essentially is used to say there's an enterprise and a group of entities and individuals who collaborated essentially in the commission of a what's called a predicate act or an illegal act. Here we know we've had a predicate act, the sales of the unregistered and securities, and essentially the engagement of securities fraud and other crimes. And that predicate act is sufficient. Then we create the enterprise, right, or identify the enterprise. That enterprise is comprised of a bunch of individuals and entities who benefited and participated in the fraud. So there's a lot of people, but that is still being constructed because there may be multiple complaints, and how we construct that is still subject to our analysis. We don't want to discuss our thoughts on that on this recorded platform, but we certainly have done the analysis, have been doing it, and have already created structures for a number of targeted litigations that will trigger the RICO counts. So,
I've noticed a number of people asking where they can download a copy of this the Salzano and Grabato indictment. I put a link into the chat. You can also go onto the Omni website for the case if you lose that link. If you go onto the Omni website for NRIA and you go to the documents list, and then it starts with plan and disclosure statements, schedules, and SOFAs. You scroll all the way down. The last thing listed there is DOJ indictment of Ray E. Grabato II and Thomas Nick Salzano. You click on that, it'll pull up the indictment for you to review. The SEC enforcement action is right above that too, if you would like to read that as well. And I believe I see the question that just popped up about the status of the SEC case. I believe the SEC case is being stayed pending the criminal indictments, while the criminal indictments are going forward, which is typically how these things proceed. Typically the civil matters don't proceed until after the criminal matters proceed, because otherwise the civil defendants would be heavily prejudiced by having to defend the criminal action first. Second.
Actually, it's more because it's because the DOJ does not want negative testimony in the civil action that it could impact the criminal prosecution. It's actually, I think it's really the DOJ who's saying their DOJ, the Department of Justice, moved to stay the SEC action. So they did so to stop and make sure that testimony within the civil action would not impair the criminal the criminal charges against the bad actors. Because if civil testimony was adduced that exculpated these individuals, it would impact the criminal prosecution or damage the prosecution. So they didn't want that, so they stopped it. So that's that. So in terms of, yes, Ice Miller, answer another question. Ice Miller is staying on post effective date to work with the trustee and Rick in conjunction with the litigation and the real estate. So we'll be staying on for with that. What else?
I noticed the question, if 4901 Bergenline is sold, will the investors associated with this property be settled immediately? So if you recall from our prior discussions and from the plan, what the plan does is it has what's called a substantive consolidation, so that all the investors are put into a single pot and all will recover from the same assets. So there is no more distinguishing between investors in 4901 Bergenline or 1300 Manhattan or whatever. All the investors are recovering from the same pool of assets, and no one is recovering. No one has a priority in any specific property longer. And frankly, the reason for that was because the debtors did that arbitrarily in the first place. It was part of the Ponzi scheme. You know, they would put you in this one property, and you know, it was basically a crapshoot as to whether you got a good one or a bad one. So it's not, you know, it doesn't make sense to, you know, pick winners and losers based on who the bad actors, you know, gave winning lottery tickets to.
Ed Labello, who is one of the best bankruptcy lawyers I've ever met, I think just asked a question, which is that if is a contributing investor considered to be an allowed claim? Mike, I'll give that to you.
So if you are a contributing investor, your claim will be allowed in the amount set forth in the investor schedule on the effective date, subject to, you know, reallocation based on what we discuss, you know, what we discussed earlier, but you will have an allowed claim on the effective date.
Have the tax returns, if recovered, of bad actors been reviewed and evaluated? We have obtained indirectly some tax returns, but not all tax returns have been obtained yet. As you can imagine, they're very difficult to obtain and are protected under certain laws, but they are being pursued. Some of those tax returns are being studied and have been received. I don't think we by any means received all the returns that we could possibly seek to obtain, and we're in the process of doing that.
And have the bad actors or their attorneys responded to any of the indictments? So, Nick Salzano was arraigned, and he is currently, I think he's under house arrest, a conditional release, staying in his brother's house pending the trial. I do not believe that Grabato has been arraigned yet. I believe he's still on the lam in the Philippines, is what I heard last, but I'm not. Lewis, I don't know if you've had more recent information about that than I have.
No. Mm-mm.
And then in terms of the indictment, so the Scutaro information, which is like an indictment, but agreed to effectively, that is proceeding forward as well. So you can get more information on the allowed claim for your contributing investors. It is attached to the plan. We filed an amended investor schedule on the 25th of July. If you wait 1 second, I will get you the docket number of that. It is docket number 3260, which is the amended plan, and it also includes the amended excluded party list and the amended investor schedule with a red line to show the changes from the prior version.
All right. And another question was, will there be multiple distributions or payments? Yes, there will be. There won't be one lump sum. The contemplation is that as the claims are resolved, reserves are either set or eliminated, distributions will come in waves as funds are received, recovered. And there'll be 1, 2, 3 distributions. It depends. Again, that is subject to the trustees' analysis as we go through and the funds come in. But that's traditionally how it happens.
Would it be possible to seek extradition of Grabato from the Philippines? So extradition would be something that the criminal authorities do. That's not something that we would necessarily do. So I'm assuming that if they catch him, they would seek extradition. I don't know if the Philippines has an extradition treaty, but I believe it does. But again, that's for the U.S. Attorney's Office of the District of New Jersey, not for us. The confirmation will include language forbidding future transfers. So it's not the confirmation order specifically, the liquidation trust agreement, which is the document that controls the liquidation trust and distributions through the trust. you know, sets forth the powers of the liquidation trustee. That has a provision in it restricting transfers of interest in the liquidation trust. And the reason for that is because if a secondary market, if there were too many transfers of liquidation trust interest to the point where it could be considered effectively publicly traded, is the way to think about it. There are IRS rules that would have very negative tax consequences for the trust, which would then flow through to you. So in order to avoid the very negative tax consequences, we have to include a restriction in the transferability of interests in the liquidation trust. And that is exactly the same reason why the operating agreement for the fund and the PPM included restrictions on the transfer of interests in NRIA, was to avoid the same negative tax consequences. So this isn't a new restriction. This is the same restriction that was in place before. There's a little bit of a gray area in terms of the claims in the bankruptcy case, but once the liquidation trust comes down, there will be a strict restriction on the transfer of liquidation trust interests.
Right. And we have one last question, I think, which is, if we have a change of address, how do we provide such and where? And I think that's through Omni, right, Mike? And then Docket.
Yeah, there's a change of address form through Omni. You can contact them to change your address. And then after the liquidation trust comes effective, we will likely have to hire a disbursement agent who will be responsible for sending out checks. We will work with them to make sure that they are maintaining an appropriate register of current addresses of all the investors and all the other creditors.
Thank you. I think those are all the questions. I don't see any new ones unless I missed one. I apologize. There are quite a few, but we went through all the best we could. We will have, I think, the next call once the trustee is in place sometime in 2 months from now. We will post that notice. You'll see some additional movement on the docket, things related to the confirmation order. But realistically, September and October, things should start picking up quite a bit again, and we'll have a very robust call then. So thank you all. We really appreciate your involvement, your help, and we hope to keep you continuously informed and, more importantly, recovered. So let's get this done for you. So thank you all very much.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.